So our hands are tied there. Other than the speed limit, as I had explained to me, the speed limit is the condition of the road, not what the posted speed limit is. And this came up.
The conditions, yes.
The conditions 15 years ago when we were looking at putting a coffee shop at the end of Big Springs Road and Highway 97. Mm-hmm. Where all of a sudden you got 12 driveways within 300 yards coming on there. The speed limit is 55 miles an hour. Somebody's going to get T-boned. Mm-hmm. But no, we couldn't take it down. But and yet the county turned around, and then on Big Springs Road, because of one person living there, they went and set the speed limit at 45 miles an hour. I'm seeing all kinds of things here.
I can comment potentially or add something potentially, but typically it's a speed study, and it's the 80th percentile. So you can't, a jurisdiction can't just set a speed sign out saying we would like people to go slower. Mm-hmm. So they do a speed study and they see what the speed is when it's unconstrained of the average driver. So the prudent driver is from 1% to 80%, and non-prudent is the 20%. The remaining 20% deserves a ticket. We're going to set the speed limit at that. So it's a vehicle code issue where the drivers have. Each, you and I, as we're driving, has a perception of what's prudent to drive naturally. And that's that 80th percentile, and that's how they've set it. I used to work at Caltrans.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's how the CHP sets it. But there may be other circumstances, like a school zone, uh-huh. There are certain other statutes that allow some other changes. But on an open highway, open local road, it's a speed study, 80th percentile. It's, so if people feel free and they feel it's safe, they're making a judgment, prudent driver, that it's safe. And if 80% are going that speed, that's what they set the speed as. So if you get a speeding ticket, you can take a ticket to the judge and say, somebody artificially set the speed limit lower. I had this speed study done, or this is, I dug up this old speed study, and this is what it should be set at. And so.
Tony and I are the only ones, but that was
brought through the chair.
Because cities.
Through the chair.
Oh.
I have some people that are commenting that they cannot hear certain individuals. So if everybody can make sure you use your microphone, they won't be able to hear you at that point.
But Lauren may have more comments about this. He's a traffic guy.
That was brought on, I think, because of the speed traps cities were putting in,
yes.
in place. And so they turned it over to the state of California and Highway Patrol. A city like Montague couldn't say, I want a 10-mile-an-hour speed limit, catching people going at 15. So that's why the jurisdiction changed from the local to the state.
Well, back to what Tony was saying.
Am I not right?
The places right? on that road where there's some pretty good blind corners there, and you better be slowing down.
Through the chair, with all due respect to speed limit signs, when I was coming to this meeting this morning, some lady in a BMW passed me like I was parked. And the posted speed limit is 70 miles an hour. If she wasn't going 90, forget it. So my point is this, you can put up all the damn signs you want and people are not even gonna pay any attention to them.
So that's interesting. So CHP does have jurisdiction even on county roads. Just not on private roads.
Right, in my past experience working with transportation and posting of speed signs, it's a speed study, and CHP has the ultimate authority.
Hmm, okay. Okay, I've got another question docked up. Are you ready? Okay, no one else is jumping in.
No, I'm restless enough.
So, the water question.
He had to leave.
Yeah, oh, he had to leave. Had to leave around 3:00.
Okay, perhaps staff can shed light on this. So I am looking at the Appendix N, okay. The wastewater feasibility study. I'm on attachment C that has the table for occupancy and estimated flow rates. And it struck me as interesting. I'm curious where the values came from when, for example, looking at the mobile camping areas 1, 2, and 3 with a average gallon per day per person being 50. I don't think I use 5 when I'm camping, and at home when I'm not camping, I doubt if in a given day I'd go much over 15 or 10.
Yeah, Chris Cummings, so I was the author of that report. So that attachment, I have embedded somewhere in the language in the report that mentions that it's based on the EPA design manual. Okay, so the EPA design manual, it has the published rates for different uses. So this is conservative, you're right, that's a high number. And I do mention in the text that using measures that are water conservation measures that are modern, and this the design manual is hasn't updated that, so that they're still high volume numbers. A low flow shower head, low flush toilets. There's potential to reuse gray water in subsurface pasture situation, but it wouldn't be done if you can't. But so it's likely that that number is going to be considerably lower. So again, this is a conservative estimate.
Okay, because I take 4 high school boys with me down to the races for 6 days, and I have 100 gallons in the RV, and we've never run out in 5 years.
But boys.
Okay. I mean, I end up having to empty it at the Willows, and it's, I doubt if we go through more than 25 gallons in 5 days.
I just remember when my daughter was in high school, couldn't get her out of the shower.
Well, my teenage boy at home is like that, so I do understand. Okay, I was just probably wondering where these numbers came from, because they seemed awful high.
It's probably an average in there.
Okay.
Okay. But anyway, it's the EPA design manual.
Okay, so stay where you are.
Okay.
So looking at the this camping, the proposal in the wastewater is that septic will also be the
groundwater recharge.
Groundwater recharge, but that'll be the collectible. It'll be septic for the RV,
correct.
Not some other.
Correct.
Design.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's a provision not to to put up a sign to not use the chemical tablets. I think that was a mention from Fish.
I saw that in
I
several
that,
places.
Yes.
Okay. All right. That answered that question, because I was looking at the potential flows and the numbers just seemed really, really high. Okay, I think that was the only question I had on that table. Mr. Hart or whomever.
Let me just clarify a question. Let me look at this one. On the vehicle impact to Kirkirk Road, there have been several projects that have come through the county, specifically gravel pits, where the road department required a road tax be assessed for the number of trips going up and down the road every year. Is that a policy? Is that just something they came back because they thought they'd be gouged from the pit owner? To me, it's not applicable because you pay your taxes through diesel tax and everything else. And I'm not in favor of that, but is that something that needs to be addressed here? With all these vehicles going up and down that road, there's going to be maintenance on that county road. And you know, that was 20 years ago when that was pushed through, and nothing's come through since. And I know that's quite the complaint from the road department, that anybody that comes in here to the county to get a use permit, that they need to be paying even more tax.
Can't say that I have a good answer for you on that, Commissioner Hart. My experience with that is associated with a few mine sites around here, quarries, where that was implemented through the reclamation plan.
There's no specific county policy that sets that, and so it's not applicable.
I don't know for a fact, sir.
It's a charge per yard, right?
See, Public Works has some policy to that effect. Planning, community development, we do not.
Do you have a charge per yard? Do they charge you per yard?
We've got it down to a flat fee.
A flat fee?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in that instance, you're dealing with trucks that are loaded potentially, so, not typical passenger vehicles.
All right, but I look at what goes up and down Harry Cash Road. Don't go there.
That's right. Don't go there.
You ought to talk about traffic.
I was on Harry Cash on Sunday. No comment.
I tell you, when I pull out of the driveway, I'm looking both ways. I don't know.
You better look twice, because they're coming quick.
I think it's the mothers going to Little Shasta School. Look out. Head for the bar pit.
Talking about my aunt. Okay, my next question is, they were referenced. Did I open the wrong one? Which of these appendices had the three previous use permits incorporated? Was that wasn't in the DEIR old? Was it in Appendix A, the MND draft at the end? I'm trying to remember. I had three questions related to those. Okay, yes, I think. Wait. Maybe. That's traffic. Related to the question, but here's my general question. It is referenced in the current staff report that past approved mitigation measures from past use permits would be incorporated into the current use permit as they fit in. Some of them have become irrelevant because of new mitigations. My question is on the use permit from the 90s and the use permit from the mid-80s, there was a section that was completely blank that had been noted for inspection comments by somebody physically visiting Kidder Creek Orchard Camp, and it looked like it should have been dated who visited, what they saw, but they were blank. Do we in the planning department have a record of visitations that were to have occurred per the 80 use permit and the 90s use permit? Because they were entirely blank on the portion where it looked like visitations and inspections were to occur.
Yeah, in the previous use permit files that I've seen, I've only seen the staff report and the land use permit with the associated conditions of approval or mitigation measures. I don't remember seeing any inspection reports.
It's bugging me which of these appendices those were in.
I'll try and look.
Bingo. Found it. So, and this brings up my next line of questioning with the mitigation monitoring program, the MMP.
Mm-hmm.
So the first, and this is the use permit from 95. On PDF, it's page 126 of 227. UP 9512, MIT measure 1. The first is on groundwater quality, specifically noting that Kidder Creek shall maintain drinking water flow records and population records through the 96 camping season for ranch camp, log cabin, camp kitchen, the log cabin, camp bathrooms, and at the conclusion of 96 camping season and prior to 97, the camp will construct any system upgrades determined necessary by the health department. And as a portion, there's a table down below for date, signature of monitor, percent complete, actions, accomplishments, and it's blank. Do we not have any report from that?
No, within the planning department, I'd have to look into records and see if we do from our organized camp inspections that we've done by environmental.
Or it could be held at the county health department.
And
since that was the
on site also.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anybody from camp aware, because you were just about
year?
You just came in 96 or 97.
2000.
Okay. So it was before all y'all's time.
Yep.
Okay.
So where are you going with this?
Well, so my reason for bringing up the question is we had in 95 a mitigation monitoring program. And in the staff report, and it was brought up in a letter, a concern of monitoring the mitigation measures that are before us. And I don't see a discussed, prepared monitoring program.
Correct. There is not a final MMRP yet. I believe the way the CEQA guidelines are written is that that document is needed prior to the final EIR being certified by the State Clearinghouse. So it is a requirement for staff to submit that report or that document with the notice of determination that we send to the state. So the consultant is still working on that document.
So here's my question. Been sitting in this chair for a few years, and I have seen on at least six occasions, six projects since I've been here, when an EIR is done, the monitoring has accompanied it, and we have approved both. Are you telling me that the monitoring, the MMP, will be coming before us for approval, discussion, etc.? Or are you thinking it will not come before us? Because on projects that have had them as a part, we have seen them have discussion, taken action, and then move them on to the supervisors, but they've always accompanied the relevant mitigations and the EIR.
Yeah, so the thought would be that you guys, the commission would not see the document. It would go before the Board of Supervisors.
Yeah, let me comment. I have discussed with staff this, and the lack of the MMRP has been noted internally, I believe. And it does look like, when I look at other jurisdictions, not just the six projects you mentioned, that it's the usual practice
but the MMRP comes along with the EIR and it kind of makes sense. That all being said, I did look at the issue independently, and technically it is not part of the formal CEQA approval process, and it is not due until such time as the EIR is about to be finally approved, and I guess thereafter certified. But that all being said, I realize the practical matter is we've all got the project in our heads right now, and we're discussing mitigation measures, and it sure would be nice to have the MMRP here at the same time, and I don't disagree with you on that. But the fact of the matter is staff doesn't have the MMRP from the consultant, and technically does not have to be part of this portion of the CEQA approval process. It's a follow-on document. And I can tell, I sympathize and I agree. As I say, I have discussed with staff how much preferable it would be to have the MMRP. So, in a way, you're preaching to the choir, and we don't disagree with you on a practical note.
I guess we've taken the time to go through close to 2,000 pages of documentation, knowing this project inside and out over the course of the last, we got the first document dumped back in July. I've been living, breathing, and eating these pages since then to be first familiar with it. And it raises a potential flag when I'm looking at a 95 use permit that has a monitoring plan with empty tables, and we have a 2022 EIR neg deck with mitigations with no monitoring plan accompanying it. And we have made some additions to conditions. We have made some recommendations for the supervisors to take into consideration our thoughts and recommendation on some things that are intricately connected to said monitoring plan, which we don't have before us. And I, counsel, you say it does not legally, procedurally have to come before us, but it will be accompanying this plus our discussion when the supervisors see it?
That appears to be the intention, and that when it's finally before the Board of Supervisors for final approval, which is probably a practical reality of the second reading of the ordinance for the zoning change, the MMRP will be there as well. And I realize the Planning Commission, in some sense, it goes to the heart of what the Planning Commission does, so of course it would be preferable to the Planning Commission to do it. But apparently it will be coming to the Board of Supervisors.
Now, will the other commissioners?
Through the chair?
Yes.
Just to add on to this item, in an effort to move this project forward, and in working with the consultant that had prepared the EIR, the way they wrote the contract, which was before our time, was that they would provide the MMRP within 5 days of the notice of decision, which I believe is CEQA language from the guidelines. That's the legal, basis for it. So our hands are sort of tied in a sense because we weren't there during the contract being created, and so this is language that we're kind of now having to deal with as we're taking the project through the process.
This contract with the subcontractor was done probably, what, during Christie's time?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And to be clear and on the record, this consultant for the EIR is not associated with Kidder Creek. They're simply looking and preparing the documents for the county.
Correct.
Because at the time, we had Rachel.
Yeah, correct.
She was the planning department, and Janine.
Correct. Right. And in some cases, right, you try to push consultants, you know, beyond a certain timeline that's, you know, maybe a little bit more aggressive, but, you know, sometimes consultants, they also stick to the exact wording in the contract, which is a situation we're in.
So, if none of the other commissioners are opposed to this, I would like to formally request staff provide, at least me, I would like to see what that monitoring program plan looks like. I'm not saying I want to see it before the commission, but I want to see the document before it goes to the supervisors. So if I see something that stands out as a planning commissioner for the district that this project is being done in, I can then make a phone call to my supervisor, Hal, and communicate with him what I see as a potential yellow flag, red flag, or hey, thumbs up, it looks good.
Correct.
We can do that.
And I'd like to see the document as well.
Okay.
Yes, I will forward that on to the commission.
As soon as it is in your hands,
yep.
Shoot it to us, please.
I will do that.
Okay.
Whoa. I'm going to go back to the letter that Ms. Birch sent to us here regarding MMRPs.
Oh.
That we're kind of
what page you
approving
on?
Something, and we don't have MMRPs in our hand to approve first.
Well, that's why I asked counsel if we had a problem, and he's saying that it's not due until the date that the EIR is to be finally voted on. So here's the question, the date that it's to be finally voted on by us before it goes to the supervisors, or the date before it's voted on by the supervisors as the final stop?
Well,